Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. When a roadside bomb blew up in southern Baghdad last night, 4 U.S. soldiers were killed. And with that, the death toll of American military in Iraq hit 4,000. No more or less meaningful than 3,999 or 4,001. But it is a milestone, another 1,000 military lives lost. It hits the headlines and reminds us that we need to pause and think hard about what they and the nearly 30,000 U.S. wounded and those patrolling Iraq streets right now endure and sacrifice. This hour On Point, 4,000 U.S. military men and women dead in Iraq. We begin today at the Pentagon with NPR's Pentagon correspondent Tom Bowman. Tom, thank you for joining us.
Hi, Tom.
How's the U.S. military as an institution treating this number, Tom?
Well, the Pentagon officially is not saying they're at 4,000 yet. It's somewhere 5, 6, or 8 below that. And the reason is there's always a lag in notification of next of kin. So they're not saying they're at 4,000. Associated Press and other news organizations are calculating it at 4,000 at this point.
We've seen, in spite of that, the military responding, saying, you know, there's no special significance to this number one way or another.
No, I think that's right. And I went back at January 2007 when there were 3,000 American deaths in Iraq, and President Bush did not specifically acknowledge that, but a White House spokesman at the time said the president, quote, grieves for each one that is lost and said their sacrifices were not made in vain.
Dick Cheney today, who's been in the region talking about this as well, and saying, the vice president saying here, you regret every casualty, every loss. It may have a psychological effect on the public, but it's a tragedy that we live in a kind of world where that happens. The vice president portraying this as just sort of part of the times we live in, maybe a necessary cost of those times.
Well, clearly this is going to raise the issue of why U.S. troops are still in Iraq. And, you know, a number of politicians, President Bush and John McCain, have saying we'll stay there until we win. Well, the question is, how do you define winning in Iraq? I think that's the debating point. Saddam Hussein is dead and buried himself. There's a government in Iraq. There's a Iraqi security forces, hundreds of thousands of police and soldiers and so forth. So then the question is, how long do you stay? And the American military says, well, we have to stay until they're ready to take over the Iraqi security forces. And I was just over there back in the fall, and we'll return in the next month.
Mm-hmm.
And clearly, it's the Iraqi security forces are a mixed bag. The army tends to be a little better than the police forces, but it's going to take some time. They estimate anywhere from 2009 to 2012 before the Iraqi forces are ready to really take control of the country from the American forces.
Looking here at some numbers that USA Today put together, Tom, of the casualties, American casualties in Iraq, 98% male compared with 99.9% in Vietnam, three-quarters non-Hispanic white compared with 86% in Vietnam, the most common age of dead, 21, just slightly older than the 20 in Vietnam, 9% officers. More of the fallen based at Fort Hood in Texas than any other military installation. New York City, the town or city that's lost the most with 62, more than half of this 4,000 killed by bombs, 16% by enemy gunfire. Tom, have you looked at the demographics out of the entire American population? I mean, we see here that, you know, sort of a racial breakdown and something about the parts of the country. But have you looked at where those who serve and those who die are coming from as a demographic measure?
Well, generally, the U.S. military, they come from small towns, mostly in the South. If you look at the recruiting data, and that, of course, would jibe with those who are in the service and consequently those who lose their lives or are wounded. It tends to be a band that starts up around Minnesota, goes straight through the heartland of the country, down through the southern states, through Texas, along the coast, the Gulf Coast, and then up to maybe around southern Virginia, Maryland, And that's sort of where it stops. More recruiting from those areas. Again, you know, some of this has to do with economics. People trying to get out of small towns, trying to get money for college, they tend to be the ones who are enlisting and therefore dying in greater numbers. The coasts, both coasts of the United States, you don't see heavy pockets of recruiting there, except for maybe inner city. But that's sort of the demographic, I guess you would see, and mostly white.
Though we have to say, I mean, when you look at the death toll, the casualties do go coast to coast and reach right at this point into every corner of the country.
Sure.
I wonder how the military looks at this number. I mean, again, this is from the USA Today report. They're comparing it. They say this total, 4,000, is less than two-thirds the U.S. fatalities during the World War II Battle of Iwo Jima, which lasted about a month, less than U.S. losses on each of the first 3 days of the Battle of the Bulge in World War II, less than a fourth of U.S. fatalities in Vietnam in 1968 alone. So is this seen in some professional soldiering way as a good number, a low number, given how long the country's been
in Iraq? Generally, if you talk to most military professionals, they would say it's relatively low. And as you're right, compared to the battles in Vietnam, and especially World War II with Iwo Jima and Okinawa and the Battle of the Bulge, the greatest land battle in U.S. history, the Battle of the Bulge. So these are relatively small numbers. But again, the question becomes, you know, what are U.S. troops doing in Iraq? Why do they still have to stay? How long will they have to stay? So the real concern with the U.S. military, particularly its leaders, General Casey, the chief of staff of the Army, has made this point. They're very worried about straining the American military. That's the problem they see. They're losing captains in large numbers. Recruiting is still very, very difficult. And as a result, they've had to take more recruits without high school diplomas, grant waivers for those who have been involved in minor crimes, and take more of those who score lowest on aptitude tests. So the real concern with the military is the quality of the force that they're getting today and also just being stretched in Iraq in particular. Of course, they're still in Afghanistan too, but we're largely talking about Iraq here. And if they do draw down to 15 brigades by the summer, that's still 140,000 troops in Iraq, and that's more than they had in March of 2003 for the run to Baghdad.
General Petraeus in Washington this week to talk with President Bush, among others. What is he expected to advise?
Well, it's been pretty clear that Petraeus wants to keep as many brigades as he can through the summer and into the fall. I mean, he wants to have a pause in the reduction of U.S. troops. So people I talk with at the Pentagon say you'll clearly have 15 brigades through the summer, and they're speculating you may reduce maybe one or two brigades sometime later in the fall, but that's not certain yet. And Petraeus says, listen, things are getting better there. Security is much better. Why accept too much risk by reducing U.S. forces too early? So that's what he's saying.
Tom Bowman in Washington covering the Pentagon for NPR. Tom, thank you very much for being with us.
Good to be with you, Tom.
I want to go to Paris now and Alyssa Rubin, Deputy Baghdad Bureau Chief, correspondent for the New York Times. She wrote a story recently headlined Aloft with a Silent Companion. Alyssa Rubin, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Can you describe for us the flight you were recently on and the soldier that transfixed everybody on that flight?
Sure. It was just a flight. I was going down to Kuwait in order to actually go back into Iraq. There's a complicated route you have to take into southern Iraq if you're traveling with the military. And when I got on the plane, I had never actually been on one of these military transport planes before. And
this is the big C-130 Hercules.
The big C-130s, right.
Where you sit up against the wall, against the netting. It's very stripped down
netting,
inside.
And it's you're kind of rock. There are no real windows. You can't really tell where you are. It's a very somewhat disorienting experience. But in the back, what they had was a coffin. They'd cleared out an area where the seats should be, and there was instead a coffin covered with an American flag. And it was this sort of silent presence that, you know, was not something that anyone could ignore. And in fact, we were told, you know, to be careful not to put our knapsacks on it, that sort of thing. But mostly, I think it made you think a lot about where you were, and it wasn't, you know, as when you travel with the military, at least as a reporter, you kind of, if you do it a lot, you get used to it, and you, it almost becomes something you don't think about very much. And this was a moment when it was inescapable.
How long was the flight, Alyssa?
Oh, it was about, it was very complicated, but it ended up being about 2.5-3 hours.
And who were the other passengers? Who else was on the flight?
You know, it's a mixture. You know, the way these flights work is the military really runs almost like I don't know what to call it, like an air
shuttle service
operation. There were a lot of people going on R&R down in Kuwait, or maybe they go to Qatar.
But these were troopers, soldiers who were sitting around.
Everyone else on it was a soldier. Yeah.
Were they looking back to the coffin at the rear?
No, a lot of them, a lot of people just looked above it. A lot of people closed their eyes and kind of dozed off. I think people don't want to look at something like that because it's a reminder either of people they've lost, buddies they've fought with and or just been with.
Alyssa, hold on for one moment if you would. We'll come right back. We're talking about 4,000 dead in Iraq. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking today about the milestone 4,000 dead in Iraq. 4,000 U.S. troops now dead for this war. Is it just a number, or are we obligated to stop and contemplate the sacrifice? Are you numb to the death toll now, or feeling it more keenly as the war goes on? Military members, families, how should the country consider this number, this toll of sacrifice? How should we honor it? Think about it. Alyssa Rubin has joined us from Paris. She's Deputy Baghdad Bureau Chief for the New York Times. She was recently on a flight across Iraq, a big C-130 Hercules, soldiers moving from base to base, strapped in with their backpacks and trunks on pallets and down the middle of that great big plane as they do on the transports. And at the rear, what she described in the Times magazine as a riveting sight, a single coffin draped in a pristine American flag. And Alyssa, you wrote the flag so perfectly clean in this country of dust, the stars of white, pure as farmer's cream, blue, brilliant navy, red, true and strong, and strapped at its base like the luggage, moving not an inch on this flight. What were you imagining that the soldiers were thinking as they flew along? Is this just every day? They're not. We don't see these coffins, even now, as you know. But there they were, fighters staring at it.
Well, I think they also don't see the coffins so much either, and it's probably I don't know, of course, what they were thinking. I couldn't hear them over the din of the plane if I'd even wanted to talk to them. But I think people always think in those situations, and I've heard enough soldiers' conversations. You know, they think about the close calls that they've had and that other friends of theirs have had, because certainly combat troops have, almost all of them had moments when they caught their breath and weren't sure if they were going to be able to go home. And I think you do think of that. And also, you probably, some of them were trying not to think about it. You don't want to think too hard about a life ending, because all of these soldiers are either quite young, or some of them, if you look at the list, they're in their late 30s or 40s. They have four kids. They're leaving a lot behind. And I don't think you can look at a coffin, a soldier's coffin, and not think about where they came from and who's left behind and what it was like to get that news on the, you know, when the military comes to your door to tell you. And that is very much a reality that's happened to a lot of families, and it's happened a lot in sort of concentrated places in military, you know, obviously in towns that have big military bases. So those are quite sad places, I think, right now.
You learned later of the fallen soldier whose remains were in that coffin. What did you learn?
Well, you know, I really didn't learn very much, but he was from Baghdad and he was a specialist, so he was quite young.
An American soldier posted in Baghdad, 20 years old, you said, specialist as
right.
What we used to call a private.
What you used to call private, and probably he in today's terms, he probably had some area that he actually did specialize in, mm-hmm. as well. But yeah, that's right.
And what was he doing when he was killed?
He was going to as I understood it from someone else on the plane, he was going to a memorial service for three other soldiers, two or three, it was a little unclear, who had been killed a few days earlier by an improvised explosive device, basically a roadside bomb. And so he was trying to go and pay his respects and honor to a fellow soldier when yet another bomb blew up. And, you know, sometimes it doesn't always happen that way, but there have been an awful lot of people who died not directly in combat. They're just going from point, in other words, they're not shooting at people at the time. They're going from point A to point B. Mm. They may be on combat missions, but but they're hit at a time when they don't expect it. There's nor does anyone with them.
A single coffin in red and white and blue at the rear of that plane, one of many planes, now one of 4,000. Alyssa Rubin, Deputy Baghdad Bureau Chief for the New York Times, joining us from Paris. Thank you, Alyssa, for being here.
Thank you.
I want to go now to Washington and Anthony Cordesman, expert in national security strategy, senior fellow at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. He's been good enough to join us many times during this now five-year and counting war. Anthony Cordesman, thank you very much for being with us today.
Hello, Tom.
So you think a lot about big issues in this war. Does 4,000, this number, this death toll count as something big? How do you look at it?
I don't think that this is more than a symbol, because we're talking about an ongoing, almost constant process. And you can define the number in so many different ways. This is 4,000 dead. It is not 4,000 killed in action. That figure will come later. It is 4,000 in the perspective of nearly 30,000 American wounded. That total will probably be reached relatively quickly as well. Out of the wounded in action, a very large number of people are going to be people who have been severely disabled. Some of them have been crippled for life. So we're talking about something that goes far beyond simply some statistic on the number killed. The patterns, too, are at this point uncertain. You look back to last year, and at the height of the surge, you had 120 killed in a peak month. That was May of 2007. That number dropped to as low as 14 in December, but it's risen since. It was 34 in January or 25 in February. And then if you look at the number of wounded, which often gets ignored, that peaked at something like 753 a month in June, and the numbers are still well over 200. I think it is dangerous to forget that sacrifice and that cost. The problem for all of us is we don't know in the course of this coming year whether the progress we made in dealing with Al-Qaeda is going to be translated to much lower U.S. casualties, whether we are going to face a new wave of suicide bombings and efforts to raise the casualty level to influence American domestic political opinion, or whether we'll see problems and divisions within Iraqi society create new sources of violence. Mm.
You know, there have been sort of two levels of debate or controversy, well, many levels, but of course the big one, whether American troops should have gone in there, whether they should be there at all. The other, whether they've been adequately protected, armed, and armored while they've been there. In your assessment, on the latter, how is the country doing at this point in terms of, you know, giving proper protection to those who are there?
I think from the practical viewpoint, the level of protection is higher by far than in any previous war. The responses have sometimes been uncertain, but we are dealing with a very adaptable, rapidly changing threat. And often it is possible to say, yes, after 2 or 3 months, we should have done something much earlier. But often when you really go back to the initial indicators, the patterns weren't that clear. So have we done as well as we could? The answer to that clearly is no. Have we done much better than any previous war? The answer is yes. It's never going to be an easy answer. And I think we have to accept the fact that war is a very uncertain business, that you have an adversary which is creative and inventive, which knows that U.S. casualties are a key political weapon in what is a war of attrition, and in trying to drive the United States out of Iraq or Afghanistan or anywhere else we are going to fight in the future, as well as casualties that are Iraqis. And we've seen Al-Qaeda adapt already by going to new patterns of suicide bombing for precisely that kind of political impact.
Anthony Cordeson, we have listeners with questions. I'd like to take one. Mitch in Boston, you're on the air.
Hey, how are you?
We're okay. What do you think, Mitch?
My question is, is more about the survival rate of folks in the war. I mean, I know we have this statistically low number of casualties, but I don't know if statistically we have a sense of how many people are coming home wounded. I know we have such great technology on the battlefield now. So, are we finding that we have a larger survival rate, which is great? But then, with that survival rate, are we going to find benefits for these folks coming back? Because, in hindsight, we see that, on a whole, most folks feel that, people coming back from combat don't get the support of benefits from their nation. So what are the numbers of people surviving?
Yeah.
Which is probably great, but how are we going to deal with it?
Mitch, let's look at that. What about that ratio, Anthony Cordeson?
Well, the ratio of survival is extremely high, but the question you ask is one for which there really aren't any public numbers. The difficulty lies in defining what you mean by disability and what the shock, the psychological and physical costs are of being wounded. One difficulty is that as we've improved protection, you've gotten, for example, more head injuries. People are more vulnerable in areas when they are wounded that produce more serious effects. When you are seeing as your major threat people who are shooting at the head, or you have extremely large explosions which can remove a limb or produce disabling damage, these are things where we don't know the numbers, but it's quite clear that they're very serious. And there's no question that when we talk about 4,000 killed in action, or really not 4,000 killed in action, but 4,000 dead, there must be a matching number of people who have had similar physical or psychological trauma. It's also clear that it took time to organize to deal with the kind of treatment, that people were slow to react, that people are much better in dealing with the purely physical side of treating the wound than they are with dealing with any kind of psychological problem, or with characterizing the disability that people who are wounded have once they've gone through physical recovery. And there's story after story of people who have had significant disability, who've had to basically fight the system for months to get a recognition of how serious that disability has been.
And you've written, if one counts the number of men and women whose lives have been virtually destroyed by critical combat wounds, well, we've passed 4,000 long ago.
I mean, it's quite clear that's happened. It's not clear that with the proper treatment, and I think your caller raised this issue, that a lot of them can't have lives that at least are rewarding. It's also quite clear that for the families involved, this is a strain which goes far beyond the man and woman in uniform, because for the wife or the husband or the children or the loved ones of such people, it takes an immense amount of support and self-sacrifice to help many of these people to really forge some kind of new life.
Mitch, thanks for your call. Let me take another call from Michael. Michael's calling from Worcester, Massachusetts. Michael, you're on the air.
Thank you very much for your program. It's fabulous. You're wonderful. My point, and it briefly, is the 4,000 dead and the 30,000 casualties are military personnel only, which to me seems very deceptive. This is the most outsourced war in the history of our nation. What is the true cost in deaths of U.S. citizenry for the contractors, dead and wounded, which will add to that that gross, grotesque tally?
Let's see if we can figure that out, Michael. Thanks for your call. Anthony Cordesman, what about if you add in contractors? Do you have a tally of where that stands? We know there are many working in Iraq.
Well, there are many working. Actually, there are an immense number, something like 160,000 contractors. Most of them are not Americans. To the extent that we have figures on American contractors, I think what I have seen really only covers killed, and it comes from sources like Iraq Body Count. I'm not sure we have a clear count, an official count from the Department of Defense. Looking at the numbers involved, they're not really shown in the Department of Defense reporting, but it's several hundred. It is not several thousand. And this includes people involved in accidents. The bulk of the contract people, aside from a relatively limited number of people who act as sort of paramilitary protectors for the State Department and others, spend their time in relatively secure zones. As a result, the level of casualties is far, far lower than it is among the military. One thing we do need to remember, however, is that there have been very, very high levels of casualties of Iraqi military and Iraqi civilians. Here, the figures are so much a matter of debate that it's almost impossible to find reliable numbers, but perhaps the best source for anybody listening would be to look up Iraq Body Count on the web. That's as good a count as any that currently exists.
And some of those so-called safe zones, the green zone, when we read under pretty strong bombardment today, the PA system there warning people inside the green zone to duck and cover because rockets and mortars coming in. Let's get a call from Augusta, Georgia. Andrew, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi. I was wondering about the current operational tempo, the deployment tempo for people that are being repeatedly sent over there, not on their first, second, or third. I know people that are on their fourth rotation over
there. Are you active military, Andrew?
Yes, I am. I've been in the Army for almost 22 years. But I was wondering if our speaker had any insight to the way we're being repeatedly deployed today versus, like, how we were being deployed during the Vietnam War, and what is the psychological impact for a soldier that has returned only to find out that he's going back and he's not going to be able to get out of the Army.
Andrew, our time with Tony Cordesman is short. Let me put it to him. Anthony Cordesman, we've just got a minute remaining with you, but the deployment tempo and its toll, its consequences.
Well, we do know that the second deployment is in some ways kind of a limiting factor for the soldier and the family. By the third or fourth, there's very serious strain and a much higher risk of psychological trauma and psychological pressure. And this is a key factor. Reducing from 20 to 15 brigade equivalents, extending the deployment time will reduce the pressure in Iraq, but understand that the U.S. forces also face potentially rising threats in Afghanistan. So this pressure is not going to be quickly or easily relieved.
Anthony Cordesman with the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington. Thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you, Tom.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about the milestone of 4,000 dead in Iraq, 4,000 U.S. troops. We're joined right now from Washington by Ann Scott Tyson, military and Pentagon correspondent for The Washington Post, just back from 3 weeks in Afghanistan. Ann, thanks very much for being with us today.
My pleasure.
And from Washington by Paul Kane, ex-Marine, decorated combat veteran of Iraq, now a fellow at Harvard's Belfer Center. He's surveyed more than 10,000 combat veterans on morale and lessons learned from Iraq. Paul Kane, thank you very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
First to you, Paul, on morale and how military men and women may be looking at this number. I mean, they're especially those serving actively now in Iraq, see the price every day. But here's a number. The Pentagon says it's just a number. This isn't a lottery. How do you look at it? How do they?
Well, I would say I won't speak for all the military people, but I would say for myself and those that I know, they're much more stoic about the number. As you said, it's more of a milestone. And put into context of casualties during other conflicts, it's not as great a number as it could be.
And what about on the home front? You've reported a lot on families who have, you know, husbands and wives in Iraq. If the soldiers are stoic in the field, although, you know, maybe rattled and worn after multiple deployments, what about the families at home? Do you still have a sense of a stoic military community watching these numbers, or one that's feeling, ground down a bit? And it's not the biggest number in American military history, but it's not a small number.
Well, I would say the cumulative losses definitely have their impact. And I would say that you have a home front where military families are feeling really quite disconnected and alienated from the rest of the population. I went to a funeral at Arlington recently for a service member killed in Iraq, and someone made the comment about what they described as little America and big America, with little America being the military families, the people who are bearing, you know, just almost unbearable costs, and then the rest of the country that seems, you know, somewhat uncaring. And it was particularly poignant because this service member had died side by side with another on Super Bowl Sunday. And they raised this this image at the funeral, which I thought was pretty powerful. And I guess through my own reporting, what I've found is that any time I write about somebody dying and the circumstances, I know that sooner or later I'm usually going to hear from their family, and they're usually going to want to know more information about the circumstances. And I've spoken to these family members many, many times, and it just sort of drives home to me on the few opportunities I have to actually describe a lot about what happened, that, you know, there's just sort of so much more under the surface that follows these deaths.
Paul, what about the president's getting reports today and this week on the progress? There's been a lot of talk about the surge. At the same time, a lot of opposition to this war. And now this number, 4,000, sitting in front of us. How what's your assessment of how the debate at home about the war, its progress, and its future affects the morale, the way soldiers in the field look at the sacrifice they're making?
Well, if I could just say, Tom, I agree very much with the points that Anne just made, and I think she really hit upon a key point, which is it's not so much the level of the loss, it's a question of is the burden for the war or the wars at this point being shared, in an equitable way,
yeah,
amongst all U.S. citizens. In terms of the current surge, I mean, the current surge is really, it came into the media, let's say, December of 2006, January of 2007, but it was really the culmination of about 2 years of change of strategy by the military over to much more of a counterinsurgency approach, which had not been, generally speaking, the strategy used across the boards. In terms of opposition to the war, I don't think we can really break this down into you're for the war or you're against the war. I mean, really, there's been a lot of mistakes made by many people. Military civilian leadership, Iraqis, miscalculations. The question is, what are we going to have if we just live Iraq as it is? And I think one of the key issues that needs to be looked at is what moral obligation do we have to the Iraqis? To use an analogy, I mean, if the police come and kick in a man's door and toss his house, and they mistakenly have done this, but their intention was not to do it on purpose, they have an obligation, I think, to stay.
And what about at home and military families and the tenor of the debate around the war? Americans deeply divided and many opposed on this war. Does that make it harder for families, or do they have their own doubts, which they feel comforted by knowing that many in the country are looking critically at the war? What's your take on that?
Well, I think that one is you cannot make the assumption that, you know, military families are sort of uniformly necessarily even behind the war. I mean, I'm not saying that that they aren't. Probably as a whole they are, but there's a great diversity of opinion. There may be, you know, people who are supporting their spouses in doing their job and you know, believe in service to the country, who have their, you know, deep questions about whether this is the right thing or not. So I just wanted to make sure that there is a spectrum of view inside the military and inside military families. And I guess I would say that overall, I believe that even though there is a sense of alienation and sort of disconnect I mentioned, at least broadly speaking, there is not tremendous divisiveness over just supporting the troops. You haven't seen, fortunately, instances of too many instances, at least, of just people taking out their animosity about the war, the political decisions on the people who are actually serving, which I think, you know, is sort of a maturation of the situation, you know, from the Vietnam era, and also maybe because, you know, these people are volunteering and it's more professional force, that could also play into it.
These are families, I guess, military families who know both the commitment and the cost that's there. Let's turn to our listeners and Larry in Buffalo, New York. Larry, you're on the air.
Hi, hello. Yeah, my question is, we've heard about the 4,000 that have died to date, and it's one thing that I never hear on the radio or TV or anywhere whenever they do the news, and that is, you know, how many terrorists are dead now or that will not threaten our way of life anymore, and it kind of upsets me all the time because a lot of our soldiers have given their lives for this, for our safety. And yet, no one ever reports on our successes.
Larry, let us pick it up. Paul Kane, yes? What do you say?
I think Larry has made an excellent point. You know, for all the reporting of the number of wounded or the number killed, we also need to look at how, you know, the corresponding, if I can say it, column, which is how many people were protected, how many acts of valor, sacrifice accompany that. You really, if you focus in on the number of killed in action, I think it misrepresents really the whole picture.
There was a time at the same time that we heard from some military analysts that we were creating as many terrorists or insurgents as we were killing. Did you fear that at one point? Do you fear we're still in that situation, Paul, or not?
No, I thought that was a bit of a false argument. I mean, we can certainly do things politically, diplomatically, and militarily that alienate Iraqis or the Arab world or whatever group you want to focus on. I think we did that in 2003 in Iraq when Paul Bremer fired the Iraqi army. I mean, that was an example of that, where you were creating insurgents.
I would just comment on that in terms of the casualty toll or number of killed among terrorists, as the caller indicated. I mean, on one hand, sometimes that is reported, but the Pentagon has made a conscious decision not to have these tolls of killed be a metric for their success.
In Vietnam, those were a major metric. You heard it all the time.
That the body count, yes,
and of the enemy.
Exactly, and they have consciously steered away from that. So one reason it's not reported that much is it is only selectively given out. Those numbers are selectively given out. I think on one hand, you know, obviously there have been thousands and thousands, if not probably tens of thousands, in that category, I would say, based on what I've heard in Iraq and recently Afghanistan. However, I do think that in fighting a counterinsurgency, you don't win through this kind of attrition. And exactly. One could argue that there is almost an endless source of fighters. So that is really not the best measurement, I think, in a lot of ways. But, you know, if it was out there, I'm sure that people would report it.
I
have from time to time.
Let's go to Atlanta and Andrew. Hi, Andrew. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Yeah.
I just wanted to expand upon the point that one of our listeners
or one of our speakers hit on, and that was the equitable burden for this war. One reason why I think that the numbers, the pure numbers of people that are dying, is not a good metric, is because I don't believe that number comes from the general population of the people that are supporting this war in the United States.
Have you served, Andrew? Have you served? Are you serving? In what service?
Say again?
In what service? And have you been deployed in Iraq?
In the Army. I've been deployed multiple times to the combat zone.
And who's missing from the, you know, the roll call of Americans? Who's not there?
And in response to using Vietnam, for instance, as the death toll as a metric for the burden of the war, not the draft. So you have more people participating in the war. And this is not the case in this war. The general population is not participating in the war. And it's a volunteer army, it's a volunteer Marine Corps, everything's volunteer. However, there are certain rules that keeps people from exiting during a time of need, you know, stop loss, things like that.
And so they're going back again and again, and we understand that. Let us speak to it. And Andrew, thank you for your call from Atlanta. Paul Kane, here's another active duty serviceman, Army, been in Iraq, raising again the point of the burden sharing here and equity, saying, you know, the country is not sharing equally. Look at this number 4,000. It's not spread across the whole country. As a military man, how do you look at that, Paul?
Well, I agree with Andrew. I think in, say, 2001, just after the attacks, I think President Bush missed a spectacular opportunity to mobilize the country in terms of unifying it, but also bringing us together to face the threat of some of the foreign threats that we're facing. And that's not particularly Iraq. That goes to Osama bin Laden and other militant Islamist groups. But I do agree with him. I think the burden is not being shared equitably, especially if you're giving tax cuts during a war, and you have a huge disconnect which exists right now. And I know a lot of military people would agree with me. We have people living their lives and they're not touched at all by the war, or they may not personally know anyone involved. So I think it's very bad for our society if you have people fighting and other people going about their daily lives.
We have with us from Cleveland, Ohio, Rosemary Palmer. She's mother of Lance Corporal Augie Schrader. He served in the Marine Reserves. He was killed in Iraq August 3rd, 2005. Ms. Palmer, thank you very much for being with us today.
Hi, Tom.
How do you think the country ought to be observing these fallen soldiers, this number, 4,000, the sacrifice it represents today?
What you have to realize is, for every military family, the only number that matters is one, and that's the person that they have involved. And for us, the number stopped at 1823, which was our son's number. And, you know, so it's a matter of, you know, you're concerned about your person. The whole number, you look at it, and it's just overwhelming. You can't do that.
You're with a group called Families of the Fallen for Change.
Right.
What do you hope will be the final number here? Where do you hope the tally will end, or are you focused on that?
Well, we're not focused on the final tally. What we're focused on is the fact that we have to, you know, get those negotiations going, the diplomacy going, and get Iraq in a position where we can leave so that we don't have to, you know, have all these deaths occurring.
What's your message to other families today who have lost a son or daughter or husband or wife in Iraq, Ms. Palmer?
Oh, wow. There's no one message you could give for all of them, just that the nation today, for once, is paying attention. And they have to pay attention much more often because the pain continues no matter what.
Rosemary Palmer, her son Lance Corporal Augie Schrader, died in Iraq August 3rd, 2005. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
And Scott Tyson, a final thought on the burden sharing on this day as the number 4,000 is reached, the burden sharing by this country in this war.
Well, I guess I would just relate a couple of haunting images that stick in my mind. I remember the soldier I wrote about who died on his mother's birthday in an IED in northern Iraq. I remember a soldier killed on the border in Afghanistan, and speaking to his family and mother afterwards, and all they could remember was how he talked about how cold it was and how dark it was, and they were sort of left with that image. And another who was in the city of Ramadi, and I was with him, and he was killed within a couple of days before he was supposed to depart, and I had been in the medic's office when he was getting his paperwork filled out, and his mother said, well, he was coming home, but he wasn't supposed to come home this way.
We'll remember them and all who have not made it home from these wars. Ann Scott Tyson with The Washington Post and Paul Kane, thanks to both of you for being with us. Go out with the rock group Irish American Black 47. This is from their new album, Iraq. Many of the songs written here from the viewpoint of Black 47 fans in Iraq. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Sweet home of that chopper, last sound I remember.